thought leader and influencer. This is Luba Mayegiso and the Africa Report.
Luba, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Howard. I'm good. Yourself?
I'm good, thank you. Before we get going, tell us how the family is doing. Is everybody recovering well after the brush up with the brush with COVID?
Yes, everybody's recovered. So our eldest daughter retested because she was feeling quite sick, but the results came back negative. And your dear friend Shalom is back at school.
Mm-hmm.
And writing her, I think, the last two exams this week. But right. The poor chap, the younger one, he's had a tougher time. He missed his assessment. And so they'll just write that he wasn't assessed, but he'll go to the next grade. But, you know, a strange thing happened. He went to school for the first time this week. And one of the little boys, I mean, they're grade four. This boy says to him, "Hi, Corona Man." And apparently the whole day, this boy kept calling him Corona Man. And then when it came to leaving, this little boy said to him, "Bye, Corona Man. I hope you die."
What? This is grade four.
The one is in grade five, apparently. Grade five. So we're busy fighting with the school about that. I said, how on earth does a great, you know, a kid who's 10, 11 say such a thing?
I'm absolutely floored by that. I mean, I'm hoping that the school is taking this very seriously.
They are. They said they had a meeting and they had a chat with the kids. The thing with Imi is he's that he doesn't like confrontation. So he's like, okay, we spoke, I'm fine. And I'm saying, no, I'm not fine, because, you know, they've asked the teacher to apologize. I'm saying, why must the teacher apologize? She never said anything. It's the kid. So I'd rather hear from the kid's parents, not from the teacher. But what's the teacher going to tell me? I'm sorry that one of the kids in my class said this to your son. Then what?
I found this the most terrible, terrible story. And how is he? I mean, did he take it, you know, how did he take it and how is he about it? Or is he somebody who just pushes it away?
Doesn't like getting people into trouble, because when I picked him up, he got in the car and he said to me, "I want to go straight to bed. I'm tired." And I said, "That's odd. I mean, it's 2:30. Why you want to go to bed?" Then I thought something was strange. And then when he got home, he told his mom. But he's the kind of kid that if he tells you something, you can't even tell his siblings or anybody until he gives you permission.
Yeah, yeah,
so
we've got a few
him.
Of those.
And, you know,
I've even got to ask my kids if I can discuss something on the air about them.
Yeah.
They're very sensitive.
No, he's not happy, but he's not the kind of, you know, kid who's going to make a big issue about it. But, you know, I'm suitably offended, you know, on his behalf, that I just can't understand how a kid in grade five could say such a thing.
I think that's absolutely appalling. Really, really appalling.
I mean, it's not as if he was even ill. There was nothing wrong with him. He just quarantined because he had been in contact with people, you know, who had corona. But wow, what a comment.
No, I think that's, I really do think that is absolutely, absolutely terrible. Wow. Okay. But good news that everybody is feeling, that everybody is feeling a lot better. The subject I wanted to ask you about, and I thought it's not one that I've actually even discussed on radio. Primarily because I don't actually find it that relevant, but I see the amount of coverage that it is getting and certainly being discussed in the Jewish community means that it probably is something that we need to talk about. And that is this whole, obviously the story at Brackenfell and then the story about, this white Jewish kid, who went to Herzliya School, who seems to be one of the EFF, part of EFF leadership. Now it's obviously become a big conversation in the Jewish community because here's a Jewish kid supporting an organization that allegedly has all sorts of strange and problematic theories and ideas, etc. On the other hand, and for me, why it wasn't a story is because he's entitled to do that. They're a legal party. They're an organization. I might like them. I might hate them. I might be neutral to them. But as part of his growing up experience, he's fully entitled to exercise his thought and his political, agenda or ideology, however he so pleases. So for me, it actually isn't a story, but But somehow it seems to be, and I often look to you as somebody who is very close with community, but also sits a little bit outside of it and therefore has a little bit of a different perspective than I do. So I wanted your thoughts on that.
Howard, I must confess, I've only seen two video clips that he's made. And, I mean, off the top of my head, I would say he's entitled to join any party and to have any opinion he wants. It's not a big deal. But when I listened to the two video clips, it didn't strike me as if there was a lot of depth in what he believed in and his particular stance. See, you know, he spoke about entitlement and having to, you know, march to various communities. And he basically repeated the same comments, both video clips that I saw. I don't think he's necessarily somebody that I would say is a diehard EFF supporter.
No, I wouldn't either. And I don't know the kid. He could be a genius he could be a complete moron. To me, he's a kid who's just going through his stuff and doing whatever he wants to do, and great for him. I mean, that's my whole approach to it, is I don't mind. I don't, but sorry, carry on your thoughts.
I think we shouldn't mind, you know, we should allow children to express themselves. I think also for the EFF, it's a feather in their cap. If they've got a young, you know, man who's white, who comes from, you know, obviously a background of being well off, and he's now attacking that very basis. So it's much better putting him up there than putting a black face, because if somebody who's African makes a comment, you'll be written off as typical. You would say that, whereas it's much harder to argue against him. But the real question, I think, would be, if you had to sit him down and say you're going to interview him and talk to him, would he have depth in his beliefs, or is he somebody who's really just been given a few ideas to kind of hang on to? But you know what, Howard? I see this often. You know, it's the same as what somebody might say. What would you do when a black person joins a party? You know, take the DA. A couple of years ago, a black person joining the DA was not really what you would expect. And you would have had people saying, okay, is this person a sellout? Is this, an Uncle Tom? And you'd get all those comments. But when I look at it closer at home, I look at my kids and sometimes they'll have views and I'll actually scratch my head and say, is this really my kid, or did I walk out with the wrong kid from the hospital? And I've actually said that to them several times, where I've said, I really wonder, I need to go and check those hospital records, because I'm sure I walked out with the wrong baby. Especially Shalom. I mean, she has views that will just astound me sometimes. And I'll shake my head and I'll wonder. And I think part of it is you've got to accept that, you know, the younger generation are just going to have views that are so inconsistent with what we believe and what we understand. But the real challenge is it's hard to actually engage with them and understand how they arrived at those decisions. So if I go back to my 16-year-old, I mean, this is the one that set me down and told me that I sound like a fascinating person, but I'm very opinionated. And then she went on to distance herself from our faith and everything else. And she told me, like, you know, you seem like a real fundamental Christian, and I don't think I believe in what you do. And I said, that's interesting, because you've had no problem with our faith all along. She'd be the one who'd be saying, let's pray and all of those things. So it's hard to swallow in some regards, because you kind of say, but how did we get here? Where did I go wrong? And the difficulty is that you're not engaging with somebody who's going to say to you, I think my views are changing, or I have a problem with these issues. And so they'll lash out. And in some ways, you know, we're quick to think maybe they're looking for attention. But I know that. I mean, I felt it with my kids, where we just do not see eye to eye on certain issues. And in a way that I just cannot even fathom how we got there. But it is their view. But what I'm saying is the challenge is it's not a view that articulate very well. You get more almost anger, and rebellion. And once there's anger and rebellion, it's very difficult for you to try and, you know, have a proper discussion to try and understand what they feel.
Do you think it says anything about the EFF? Because I mean, it's very clearly a white a party that is not aimed at the white community, certainly not aimed at the Jewish community. I know that we have tried numerous times, more than I can even mention, to get them onto this show, because I think it's very interesting, and I'd like to hear, I'd like to bridge gaps, I'd like to hear what other people are thinking, but they've never shown any interest in doing so, presumably, and maybe that's my own assumption, because we're not a target market necessarily, being a Jewish radio station, but a Jewish community station. But what does it say then about them if this is somebody who they've welcomed into their fold?
Look, the EFF are picky, quite picky in terms of which audience they'll appear before, which forum. But one thing that we mustn't underestimate is that they do have popularity. Mm. And we may call them opportunistic in the sense that they'll go to Senegal, they'll go to Brackenfell. But the issue remains that they often fight battles that many people kind of understand and wish would be fought, but nobody actually tackles those head on. So, they won't necessarily get support in terms of people joining them, but they have sympathy. So when I look on social media about the Brackenfell issue, for instance, there's an incredible amount of support for them in the sense that we do need to address these issues. Now, about coming to you, sure, I think it'd probably be a case of trying to find somebody, not necessarily a Juju or somebody else, but I think if you keep at it, sooner or later you will get some. The issue for me is I feel the issues that they're addressing, which are around racism, and for me, if I can digress a little bit, I do struggle with the way in South Africa we're dealing with protests and these issues. So for me, I would never vote for the EFF, but I understand why they were marching and I understand their anger. I have a different take to it. I mean, I sat this weekend with, I won't mention names, but an elderly Jewish gentleman that I've known quite a while. We had breakfast on Sunday and we spoke about race and we couldn't be farther apart. You know, when I shared instances, you know, I walked away saying, it's amazing how when we try and reach out, because I kept getting told, no, Luba, but I think you're only remembering instances where a white person was involved. People are generally bad drivers. People are generally this. And then I walked away saying, actually, as a country, we're not as close as I thought we were. And we're not really finding ourselves, because when I spoke to this gentleman, he was quick to say, yeah, I'm sure somebody else can find a similar example from the other, racial group. And then I kept saying, but are you listening to what I'm telling you? I live in Cape Town and I know Cape Town is very polarized. I mean, I know the suburb that I live in. I see these issues. I see them at school. So the EFF is raising issues that are topical. They may not be subtle about them and there may be an element of popularity, but I think we should never mistake the fact that, they're very good at finding popular issues, a popular sentiment within the black community.
Yeah, it's, what is a better way then to deal with race? We know that we've got a race issue here in South Africa, and to suggest otherwise isn't accurate. I would agree that, and I would think maybe it's in my limited world that it's not common that most people are working very, very hard on themselves to do away or to rid themselves or rid ourselves of the way in which we were schooled and brought up. I think we do have unconscious bias. I think it does exist. But I think that on the most part, there's a tremendously good intention with when it comes to most South Africans around race. And I do think that there are the odd things that we scratch our heads and say, wow, like how on earth did this happen? How did this get passed? How did this ever become a thing? And then the question is how best to deal with it. So I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm saying it does exist. I'm saying the intention I believe in for most South Africans is positive, but incidents are going to continue to happen. And my question, I guess, is how should we best deal with it? How was there an alternative to dealing with the Brackenfell story?
I think in many ways, firstly, I think it's something that really shouldn't have happened.
Of course not. Absolutely.
It shouldn't have happened. But then you see the problem, Howard, with race in this country is we go wrong in so many ways. So one, the school should have done it. Secondly, I think they should have been contrite and try to deal with it fairly quickly rather than let it escalate, because a confrontation wasn't going to help. But then I find that when it comes to race, we're still far apart, because we don't really talk to each other. And if you had asked me the same question, you know, 5 years ago, I would have said my generation that lived through apartheid carry the scars, and as we move forward, the born frees are going to bring in fresh air and a new look, approach to it. But what I find, if you go to the EFF, most of the people that will see marching with the born frees, the fees must fall, the roads must fall. The people who are more militant right now are the ones that we thought did not live through apartheid and would therefore be much easier, would have a different approach to it, more conciliatory, but that's not coming through. Now, I think what complicates issues is, if you take the EFF, what they really wanted to do was to get to the school and hand over a memorandum. Now, the question I kept asking myself this morning is, because the EFF is saying, we have unfinished business, we still haven't got to the school and given them the memorandum. And so I asked myself and said, could we police these issues a bit better? Because there is a feeling that the police are very biased when they handle these issues. And I can tell you right now that even for myself, I know that if I'm stopped by police, my experiences are seldom pleasant, because in my mind, I've also worked out that it's either I'm going to be asked for shaken down for a bribe, or it's just going to be somebody giving me unnecessary grief that they wouldn't give somebody else. So the question that I ask myself is, could the police have allowed the EFF to march, even if it was 1,000 of them, get their hand over their memorandum? Would they have necessarily destroyed property? I don't think so. But they would have achieved what they wanted, to hand over the memorandum. Now they haven't, and this is kind of escalated. So in some ways, I think we're very rigid in the sense that this is what the rule says. You allowed 100 people. Okay, we've allowed you 500. But how about this approach? I mean, I know from my student days, when people were marching somewhere, you walk out of red, say, guys, where are we going? You join. So the numbers swell as you move. So it's not something that you can police and say, well, I'm going to start with the 100 people, I'm going to end with the 100 people. So I think we keep talking. Most people that I talk to from a different racial group in my circles don't really listen to what I'm saying to them. You know, so they'll be quick to say, yes, but it's not unique. Yes, but we felt the same. So we talk past each other and we try and compare. So we still find ourselves at this crossroads where we want to believe that we've moved quite far, but there's small things that still trigger. And those small things still tell us that in the black community, the wound is still real. And on the other side, there's still a level of denial. If we can't even acknowledge the pain and the hurt, we then don't move forward. Because as long as, like I'm saying now, I mean, this was Sunday where I was chatting with this gentleman, and I felt that he was quite dismissive. And I had to, you know, no matter how many examples I gave, he kept coming back to the issue that, Luba, but are you not just remembering the cases where somebody's done something who was white? And I'm like, goodness me, you know,
what's so interesting about that is, it doesn't, that's actually not the question to be, it's not even a relevant question, because even if you are remembering that, even if you are only remembering that, it's because it has caused a wound so deep and so painful that those are the ones you remember. So that in itself is relevant. It's not relevant that you only remember those, or you do, whether you do or whether you don't. It's important because that is what you remember. And that's what makes them the important memories.
Now, bear in mind then that you're going to have quite a large Christian community that will say to you, just forgive and move on. And I saw this again on Facebook where a friend of mine says, you know what, if somebody offers you a half-baked apology, do you really kind of embarrass them by making sure that they're really contrite and remorseful, or do you just accept it and move on? And I think there lies a problem, because, I mean, we've seen it many times. You know, a person kills two or three people and the family comes out and say, oh, we've forgiven them. And then I say, but is that real? Or are you almost programmed from a faith point of view to offer forgiveness? Whereas you have not genuinely dealt with the grief. You have not dealt with the issue, with the pain. But you know that somehow the stronger thing, I mean, I would have this at home when lady would say to me, Luba, be the stronger person and do this. And I would say,
I hate that, be the stronger person. I hate that. be the bigger person, be the better person. Yeah.
Because I'm the one that keeps getting hurt, and I'm saying, no, you know, I have every right to actually sit and feel offended. You know, look, at times I might get overboard and like sulking, but, you know, we want to take away the right to feel the hurt.
That's your privilege as a male, Luba.
Sure. Howard, we're on thin ice here because I know we do sulk. I mean, I can sulk when I put my mind to it. You know, that's a different thing. You know, and you have to know that I'm sulking, you know, so I'll do everything to make sure that you're aware I'm sulking. But I think when it comes to race, I've prided myself in having a fairly thick skin and fairly robust, but there are things that are just so breathtakingly bad that you sit back and you say, but my goodness, you know, how did we get here?
So I'm going to stop you for a second. Vaughan says, just on a point of order, the EFF bust in their supporters and started off by bringing in 1,000 people, even though they knew what the rules were. If they'd stuck to the original number, the whole scenario may have changed. Look, my view on this whole Brackenfell thing is that it was handled by nobody well. So from the school, because it should never have happened, to the EFF, who are intimidating and who do use war language, to the police that could have addressed it much quicker, in a different way, et cetera. I don't think that there was anybody along this whole journey that handled it well. And that's the reason I do think it's worth talking about, because then we can look at a situation and say, well, how could we have done this better?
That's the thing. And I don't think anybody is sitting, because you take now how it's escalated with the Minister of Police and Tutu, and, you know, where kind of veiled threats are being issued. And that isn't helping the issue, because you would think the Minister of Police has a fair understanding of the fact that the relationship between the black community and the police has not been good. And Tutu may have been deliberately provocative, but as much as he was provocative, I kept saying to myself, but this is the issue. Remember I said to you when we had lockdown, and when lockdown started, and I walked out of a Woolworths at a garage, and I bought something, and there were several policemen, there were several people, and I was picked on. And you may say that again, I've got a phobia, but I was aware
But you were
in this forecourt. There were several cars, but here's the crazy thing. It wasn't a white policeman, and this is where South Africa gets crazy. It was a black policeman who singled
me out. Okay, so I wanted to actually go back to that, because I've actually made a note to circle back to that, because your comment about the police even today, and I wanted to understand from you. First of all, before I go there, I just want to read you Rakhadi's message, because it's an important one. She says, I agree with Luba. My issue with Christians is that we want to be merciful and forgetting, but we forget that it goes hand in hand with justice. So let's just put that aside. I want to go back to your comment about the police, that you know that it's going to be an unpleasant experience. I wanted to know from you if that is when stopped by black policemen or white policemen, or is it completely irrelevant?
No, if I get stopped by a white policeman, I know I'll get a fair deal. If I've infringed, if I've speeded, I'll get a fine or I'll get a warning, but I know it's going to go by the book. If it's a black policeman, I got stopped during lockdown driving to Bloom. Howard, I was at a toll gate. I wasn't speeding. There was a car in front of me driven by a white couple. The guy jumped out, he stopped, they waved him through. The guy stopped me, said, nice car you're driving. I said, thank you, it's a hard car. Well, you're off to Bloom, do you stay there? No, I work. And he went on, and then eventually said, you know what, I haven't eaten that coffee. He wanted money, but he would never ask that of the couple in front. That's why he waved them through. I know that so what you find is that a black policeman either will shake me down or feels, it's almost as if apartheid has in some ways programmed black people to say, I can be merciless and cruel to my own people. You know, I've got a friend who's undergoing dialysis. He literally walked out and he went to Canal Walk, and he gets to a shop. He gives the lady his hand so that she can take the temperature. And she says, no. And he says, can you please? She says, I want your forehead. He says, I don't want that laser thing x-ray pointed to my forehead. Please use my arm. She says, oh, you're a doctor now. That's wonderful to see. And he insists. And she says, okay, doctor, stand aside whilst I help other patients. And he was absolutely mad. Behind him was a white woman with a child. They stepped forward, extended their arms, and the lady scanned their wrist and told them what the temperature was. He stepped forward, stuck out his arm again, and the lady said, oh, so you're back, doctor. And he said, there we go. And she refused.
And this was a black woman.
It was a black woman, a security official. She refused flat. But she was happy to scan, you know, shoppers who were white using their wrist. But with him, no. And this is the issue that is boggling, where you almost say the long-lasting effect of apartheid somehow almost been to say to a black person, you know what, respect the white person no matter what, even if they're abusive to you, which is what we're complaining about in Brackenfell, that when a policeman was being pushed and shoved around, the police did nothing. But if a black person had shoved a policeman around, you know, Lord help them, that would have been hell to pay. And this is the issue. It's somehow there's this pre-programmed idea that I must respect a white person, but if I see somebody who's my own color, I can have a field day and I can almost vent out my anger. And that's the sad part. And that's why I'm saying the police do not help in this matter at all. They actually inflame a situation that they should be treating differently and saying, okay, we know the EFF is looking for a confrontation, but do we have to
say? In other words, there still continues to be a perception of bias when it comes to the police. Whether the police are black or white, in fact, more so, you're saying, in terms of what you've said to us.
No, with a white police, it's almost you don't expect any bias. You're expecting a fair treatment.
Crazy. That's the crazy. This thing really certainly gives us something to think about, and it's a conversation that we need to keep having, because the question is what happens with internalized racism, and this is really what it is. We see it with gender bias as well, where often women, and I've dealt with this in the workplace, where I've been working with some very, very successful women CEOs, but what they have found was that their worst experience or their worst treatment has come from other women. It's not a rule. I'm just talking about it from my own anecdotal position, where women have made that comment. And why is that? Because you've got an internalized gender bias and we've got internalized racism. And science says, sorry, Howard, I can't listen anymore. Look, you don't need to. It is absolutely optional. That's why our radios have both an on and an off button. So you are more than welcome not to listen. You also are more than welcome to give me your views as to why you find any part of this conversation offensive. 34519 or 0618951019. I do want to hear your view, because I think that it is very, very important. And these conversations, whether we like them or not, whether they are uncomfortable or not, and whether they make us angry or not, is equally as important. We need to look at our own reaction to these conversations and say, why am I reacting this way? Why does this make me angry? Why does this make me sad? Does it make me sad? Or why is it all completely irrelevant to me? Yossi says, Juju is a fascist, charismatic revolutionary who uses calculated strategic strategies in his aim to gain relevance and wage war. He bust in a thousand people knowing that it would give an excuse to create sensationalism.